This is KNX In Depth, an hour each day when we dig deeper, ask more questions, tell you how the major stories of the day impact you. I'm Mike Simpson, along with Charles Feldman.
Democrats are hoping for a big blue wave this November to take back the House. Republicans are hoping that wave crests early enough to stop that from happening, so California is the beachfront where everyone is looking at the wave. But what actually happened in yesterday's primary voting here? Good or bad news for the Democrats? Hope for the GOP now that the party of Trump is hoping for a big win in November? Well, we will go in depth looking for answers. Also, would you wear shoes on your feet that are alive? You may, sooner than you think, and we will try this story on for size for you.
Later on, designer Kate Spade apparently took her own life. Depression, the root cause. What do you do if you need help or if someone close to you needs help? We'll go in depth on that. And why is Attorney General Jeff Sessions still on the job when his boss keeps blasting him publicly on Twitter? Is Sessions unsinkable? Is he holding down the fort? Or does he just not get it?
Well, we begin with yesterday's election. All eyes on California, watching us for clues about what will happen in November. With us now is Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. So, good or bad news for the Democrats, good or bad news for the Republicans?
Well, Charles and Mike, I think it was a little of both. The Democrats avoided a shutout in all of those House seats down in Southern California, where they were hoping to be able to get a candidate in to the general election. Republicans in those seats all came out in first place. The fact is, when you talk about a Democratic wave, a blue wave, it was kind of like a blue splash, not exactly a huge tidal wave, but the fact is, it was enough to keep Democrats in the game in those seats, and that's exactly what they wanted. And then we saw, of course, on the statewide races, Gavin Newsom coming in a very big wave up against John Cox in November. And that's a good thing for Republicans. They're going to hope that Cox at the top of the ticket will help move their voters to the polls in November. Republicans turn out a little more than Democrats do in these primary elections. But come November, look for Democrats to get to the polls in big numbers, because in a lot of respects, this is a vote on Trump as well.
And we're already seeing the campaign rhetoric develop between Gavin Newsom and John Cox. And draw those distinctions for us. What does it look like as we go through the next 5 months and these two go head to head?
You know, well, even this morning we saw President Trump congratulate John Cox. And Gavin Newsom immediately tweeted, "Please come out and campaign for him anytime you want." That's because President Trump is one of the most unpopular presidents ever, and it is in historic lows in California. And he's going to motivate, should he decide to hit the West Coast, he's going to motivate Democratic voters to come out and Republican voters. I mean, Cox this morning sort of gave a glimpse of what script he's going to use against Gavin Newsom. He said Gavin Newsom wants to have Venezuela-style government in California, and he wants to revive the California dream. Gavin Newsom, on the other hand, is talking about immigration, ripping kids away from their parents, the Trump administration policy.
Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. When KNX In Depth continues in about 5 minutes, we will zero in on Latino voters who did not vote as some people expected that they would. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
A reminder, after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking about the suicide of designer Kate Spade and how to help others who suffer from depression. And then, why is Attorney General Jeff Sessions still on the job, even as the president spends more time criticizing him?
Right now, though, more about yesterday's election here in California. Turning now to the Latino vote. With us is Sonia Diaz, director of the Latino Policy and Politics Initiative at UCLA. She's overseeing their research on voting trends. So what exactly happened yesterday with the Latino vote in this state?
Yeah. Hi, Charles. Hi, Mike. Great to be here.
Hi.
In terms of the Latino vote, we're still crunching numbers here at UCLA, still waiting for a lot of jurisdictions to submit their precinct information. That being said, I have a lot to share with you about Orange County and the Latino vote. We're seeing some exciting news there, where we do in fact believe that Latinos made a difference. And looking at the precinct level data, which is the most accurate because we know that Latinos make up supermajority in some precincts across the state, and that's how we can best assess what impact, if any, they had on the June 2018 primary. So Orange County, we see surges. surges in the number of ballots cast in the most heavily Latino precincts, and these surges range from 10% to upwards of 245% over the ballots cast in June 2014.
So people were going out to the polls because, you know, every year, no matter what election it is, we get the stories about voter apathy, and California always kind of centers on the will anyone go out to vote this time?
Agreed. And, you know, one of the stories has always been about the sleeping giant, which is Latinos. And so in Orange County, looking at the congressional district races that were contested, California District 39, the one with Yael Cisneros, our data leads us to believe that the Latino vote in those precincts really carried Gill to the November runoff. And we saw in one precinct alone within Congressional District 39, a 245% increase in the number of ballots cast. And that precinct, again, is a supermajority of Latino voters.
So should we not read then too much into the fact that Antonio Villaraigosa, you know, failed in his bid to win a spot in the gubernatorial race, even though he was clearly against the Trump administration's policies on DACA? He has long been certainly a champion of Latino rights, but he didn't succeed.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you know, in Antonio's race, unlike the Congressional District 39, all of the front runners, at least for the Democratic Party, were universally in opposition to the president and the president's agenda. What we do know about Latinos statewide, and again, looking in Orange County, because they're the first jurisdiction to publish all of their precinct data, is that in the race of the United States Senate, we saw that in some of Orange County's most heavily Latino districts, that De Leon outperformed Feinstein.
Hmm. Okay. Just getting back to Villaraigosa for a second, because it is interesting to a lot of people. I mean, he was seen as, you know, Latino political power personified for a while, and then he couldn't even break the top two here. And we were waiting last night for L.A. County to come in. I know we're talking a lot about Orange County here, but we're waiting and waiting on L.A., and yes, there was the big snafu, the people who didn't make the rolls. But they were late for the returns, and then when they came in, it was still Newsom outperforming Villaraigosa, and he was the mayor.
Yes, that's correct. The Villaraigosa race, I think, is going to be telling. It's going to be something that all of us, irrespective of our interest in Latino voters or just California voters or all voters, are going to be talking about for a very long time. That being said, I think one of the stories from yesterday that's really clear from our vantage point here at UCLA is the role of the Latino vote, both in LA County, Orange County, and Southern California as a whole in two important statewide elections. One, the United States Senate seat, and two, Lieutenant Governor with Dr. Ed Hernandez. We believe that the Latino vote really pushed both State Senator Kevin De Leon and Dr. Ed Hernandez into the November runoff.
Now, I don't want to suggest, and I don't think you want to either, that the Latino vote is necessarily monolithic, that there are factions within it. And so I'm wondering whether it's too early to tell whether there was a difference in age range in the Latino vote.
You know, that's interesting. You know, we're still crunching the numbers, so it is too early to affirmatively say anything. You know, is there a difference in vote choice preference for Latino millennials versus baby boomers? What we do know to be true is that Latinos, as the state's plurality, are the youngest demographic. You know, nationally, 6 out of 10 Latinos are millennial or younger. That being said, of that age group, only the millennials are able to really vote. If you're inferring that maybe Villaraigosa didn't get the youth Latino vote, I think that's to be seen, and that's definitely a story here at UCLA that we're going to pay attention to.
Is there a difference in preference versus going to the polls versus, you know, vote by mail? Because sometimes it's easier if you're getting an election going, just get everybody signed up by mail and send those in. You don't have to worry about the day itself and mobilization.
Well, guys, it's even more conflicting there, because this is the first statewide election where we had automatic voter registration. So it wasn't even a matter of many voters in the state actually registering to vote per se or notifying the Secretary of State if they moved. It was all DMV. And so that's something else that we're going to assess. That's definitely going to take longer. But in terms of actual votes and what we saw yesterday, one of the other things that I wanted to bring your attention to is that we saw a surge. We saw a surge compared to June 2014, all votes cast to June 2014, ballots cast for governor. So just last night, you know, just looking at the early votes for some of the counties, we saw percent changes in terms of increases in the number of ballots cast for Democrats Democratic ballots in the governor's race, June 2014 to June 2018, we saw a 12-point increase in Merced County, a 10-point increase in Orange County over 2014, which is huge. We also saw major shifts in certain California counties, shifts from a Republican majority in terms of ballots cast for the governor's race in June 14 to yesterday for Merced County, San Diego County, and Ventura County. All three of those counties went from majority of ballots cast for Republicans in the governor race in June 14 to yesterday showing majorities for Democratic ballots cast. So that's a big story that's trending with us over here.
Okay. Sonia Diaz, Director of Latino Policy and Politics Initiative at UCLA. I picture her desk with just like mounds of paper and graphs.
I know, right?
And I'm like, better you than me.
Trying to get through that. Yeah. Well, the time is soon upon us when you go to your closet, you open it up, and your shoes are alive, living, breathing creatures to put on your feet. We're not kidding. When KNX In Depth continues.
I don't understand. You're listening to KNX In Depth. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Mike Simpson.
And a reminder that after news and traffic at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking about depression. Just a day after designer Kate Spade took her own life. And then there is more criticism from the president. So why is Attorney General Jeff Sessions still on the job?
Right now, though, the shoes. What if your shoes were alive? The design lab at MIT is working with Puma and BioRealize to design a shoe that has bacteria in it. For what purpose? With us now, director of the MIT Design Lab, Yihan Lim. Explain this one to me, the alive shoes. What do you mean?
So, yes, the BioDesign, this is a project, it's an ongoing research project that we've been working, collaborating with Puma. And the BioDesign series, it's been an experiment for us. So we've started working on these concepts since last year. And what we're doing is looking into embedding microorganisms, so those are bacteria, easily as we say, into the clothing or the shoes that we have to enhance the performances and also to customize them. And really customizing by means of reacting to our body, to the sweat and to our temperature, and then also to the environment that we use these products in, to create a very personalized experience.
So if I get this right, and correct me if I'm wrong, so the bacteria is put in the fabric or the insole, I guess, of the shoe, right? And then it interacts with a person who's, say, I don't know, running or doing some sports activity, and somehow it communicates with your smartphone to tell you what?
Yeah, okay, so I guess you're referring to our deep learning insole. So we have exhibited, there are four concepts, and this one is the deep learning insole. So what it does is that we, and this concept, it's a concept at the moment, that we have been, you know, identifying the bacteria that can analyze the sweat, and so we have embedded, created this insole that would have a layer of bacteria and then a layer of electrodes that can also take the responses of the bacteria. Then it would all send through very low energy transmission to your phone, so you can also receive the analysis of your sweat.
And
so
does
you can
it tell
me
if
the
I'm too tired
level.
Or?
Yeah, you can tell the fatigue level that you know that you may not feel fatigue, but then it can also give you an alert. So you can maybe, you know, take actions while you're running or take more water or take a break. So this is a way of using bacteria to sense your body state and giving you a more actionable steps.
Oh, you know, I was going to ask a question, but Mike, ask your question about the socks.
Oh, do I have to wear socks? Can the bacteria feel me through the sock? Or
that's been a recurring question. No, in this case, as it's still a conceptual prototype, you need to have the direct contact with these insoles. So in this case, no, it has
to
be skin to, yes.
So are you working on like socks that are alive? Because I got a few pair that are.
Yeah, so actually, that's another concept that we're working on too. So how can you embed that same type of bacteria, but then within the fabrics, within the fibers, so that maybe you can create this deep learning sock that can take the sweat level from your foot. So yeah, that's another concept that we've been also working on.
So if the shoe's alive, do you have to like feed them or what do you do with the bacteria? Do you have to treat them in some way or?
Okay, another very good question that we've been getting. So
okay.
Yes,
what do I do with
them? Yeah, since it's a live bacteria, you would have to take care of it too.
So, seriously, you really?
Yeah, as in terms of, okay, so there are different types of bacteria, and then if you want to keep them alive, for example. So this has been a concept that we've been exploring with Puma. So how do we create this user experience? Whether if they buy the product at the store, maybe the store can be the place where you can go back and then re-implant the bacteria, for example. Yeah. Or if you want, let's say in the case of a breathing shoe, where you have the bacteria that eats away your shoe, so it creates a custom ventilation pattern.
Uh-huh.
If you like the pattern that you have achieved, you can go back to the store and then freeze or kill the bacteria off. So then you would have that pattern.
Wait, you have to kill the shoes?
Okay, that's to freeze the shoe. Freeze a shoe. In another case, you can also still, you know, cultivate bacteria so that it keeps on creating your custom pattern.
It's the other shoe that if I kill on accident, I have to take back to the store and then they revive it for me.
I mean, would it be a crime to kill your shoe? Or?
No, and then you can also spray back the bacteria onto the shoe so that it can continue this action. Or you can, you know, with the UV lights or the other types of way of, you know, or you can take away the food source of the bacteria and then so it would stop growing on your shoe.
You never know what we're going to talk about on this show. MIT Design Lab, Yihan Lim, the director there. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I keep kicking this around. Well, you know, I was kind of joking about do you have to feed your shoes?
Yes, you do, actually.
Wow. Okay. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
A lot of people were shocked to hear that well-known designer Kate Spade took her own life yesterday. As we learn more, there are reports that she had depression, may have rejected some family efforts to help her because of the stigma that's attached to mental illness.
So with us now is Dr. Keita Curry, CEO of D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services. Doctor, is there something that the general public can learn from this particular sad experience with Kate Spade?
Yes, and I'm so glad that you're doing this show because the media has the power to really get the word out to people. People don't realize how common suicide is and how suicide attempts. They don't know the warning signs and they don't know what to do. So first of all, about 45,000 people die by suicide in the U.S. every year, which is about 123 people a day. So it's rich and poor. We get the impression that mainly people that are rich and famous die by suicide because they make the headlines, but really it's common among all of us. And the other thing is that people are very afraid to tell anyone when they're feeling suicidal because they often get very negative reactions. And that's just because we haven't been taught how to react. If someone told us that they had a terrible pain and they thought they might have cancer, we would be very sympathetic. But because of the stigma, we tend to be critical and sort of dismissive of people when they talk about suicide. So knowing the warning signs and knowing how to respond, which I can talk more about later, is really important.
Well, when it's someone like Kate Spade, people have a hard time wrapping their minds around it too, right? Because they think, okay, successful, and money, and looks happy,
right.
And they can't understand maybe how she was seeing things. I mean, that other person's reality.
Yeah, but the reality is, just like everybody gets cancer, almost always suicide is associated with a person having a mental illness, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, anxiety. So we all have a vulnerability to those diseases. But also, no matter how rich you are and how famous you are, it doesn't mean that you can't have problems and be suffering very quietly from terrible psychological pain.
So what do you say to somebody who confides in you that they are thinking of taking their own life?
Well, the first thing you do is you respond with compassion and you say, I'm sorry that you're in so much pain and I'm so glad you told me, because you're opening the door for them instead of slamming it in their face by saying, well, you have everything to live for, or how could you be so selfish? So respond with compassion, then find out how much danger they're in. Ask them if they have a plan about how they would take their life and if they have a method. And if they do, whether it would be pills or guns or whatever, you want to help make sure that you get those things removed from their environment. And that would generally involve, hopefully with their permission, but even if you don't get the permission, involving other people around them that are close, and then helping them get support beyond your immediate community, getting them to a therapist, taking them to the emergency room if they need that. And there is a 24-hour National Suicide Prevention Lifeline where people can call for help. If that, you know, I don't know what to do, I can't remember what that woman said on the radio, you can call for help. And also, if you're thinking of suicide, you can call the same number, and you will find someone who's a compassionate listener. Because giving someone hope, when people think about suicide, it's not really that they want to die. They want their pain to end, and they don't know how. They're desperate. And so knowing that there's a resource and someone there that can talk them through their darkest hour can really be a lifesaver.
So that would be someone who would come to you and say something that they're thinking of doing this. What are the warning signs for someone who hasn't said it outright?
Okay, and number one, if you see any of these warning signs, it's a myth that you're going to put ideas in people's head if you ask. Asking, if you ask in a compassionate way, is letting someone know that it's safe for them to talk to you. So you will often see that people are withdrawing. They're not going to the softball game they usually play on Saturday or doing their book club or whatever. They talk about suicide. They talk about feeling hopeless. They talk about having no reason to live or feeling like they're a burden. People often give things away, their special baseball collection that they've been keeping, or they take all the posters down from the bedroom. And the other thing would be mood swings, depression and irritability, and also changes in sleep. Lack of sleep has been shown to often be associated with reaching the point of making suicide attempts.
Do you ever go to outside authorities, and to whom would you go?
If you're really concerned about someone and you think they're in the midst of a suicide attempt or at imminent risk, I mean, first I would try to get them to go to the hospital with you voluntarily or with a family member, because that's going to be a less traumatic way. But if you need to, then you need to call 911.
You mentioned the numbers. I mean, how often this is happening. With that in mind, why can't we shake the stigma? Why is it still such a weird thing for people to talk about sometimes?
Because we've seen it, you know, originally as something that showed that you were possessed by the devil, and now we tend to think about it as you're just trying to get attention or you're being selfish. And so we kind of have that raise yourself up by your bootstraps approach to suicide more than we do to other mental illnesses now.
By the way, you did mention in passing the national suicide line number. Is it one number? And if so, can you give it?
Yes. 1-800-273-8255. And wherever you are in the U.S., you'll be connected to the closest line. And it's available in English and Spanish 24 hours a day.
Okay. Dr. Keita Curry, CEO of D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services. Doctor, thanks.
Coming up when KNX In-Depth continues in 5 minutes, he is hammered by President Trump, yet Attorney General Jeff Sessions is still on the job.
You're listening to KNX In-Depth. I'm Mike Simpson along with Charles Feldman.
The criticism of Attorney General Jeff Sessions continues. At today's cabinet meeting, President Trump had praise, kind words for everybody except Sessions. It's not like it's the first time that's happened either, so we want to know why Sessions is still on the job. Why would anybody stay with all of that criticism from his boss?
With us now, CBS News correspondent Paula Reed. So how much can he take? I guess this much, because he's still working.
Absolutely. This has been going on for over a year, and I've spoken with sources inside the Attorney General staff, and at this point, he's not really that fazed by the, you know, Twitter insults or these little digs like we saw today at this roundtable, because day in and day out, he is focused on doing all the things that he was really never able to accomplish as a senator, particularly when it comes to immigration. Jeff Sessions spends his days trying to deliver on the Trump campaign promise of strict immigration enforcement. And right now we see that playing out. He has made a decision to criminally prosecute everyone who comes across the border illegally, even if that has the effect of separating children from their parents. And that's really all Jeff Sessions is focused on. There are legal and political reasons, which we'll talk about, for why he can't be fired. But I really just don't think he cares about what the president thinks about him.
Well, I also wonder if there's perhaps on the president's part some method to the madness, because while the president is constantly tweeting his criticisms of Mr. Sessions, as you just pointed out, in the meantime, fairly quietly, Mr. Mr. Sessions is going about pretty much carrying out the president's agenda.
That's right. I mean, I'm not sure what the method would be to constantly insulting the nation's top law enforcement official and constantly sort of
diversion?
Insulting.
Well, diversion, perhaps.
I don't think we need any additional diversions over here at the White House. We're spread pretty thin. But when it comes to Sessions, like I said, I mean, one of the reasons, political reasons, that the president can't really fire his attorney general is that the base knows that Sessions is delivering. You know, Sessions was for the Trump campaign immigration platform before President Trump ever got into politics. Sessions has been working on this for a long time, and he is delivering. He is putting in place policies. You know, that some people are, of course, upset that they're separating parents and children at the border right now. But Sessions says, look, it is a crime to come across the border, and I want to deter people from coming here with their children. That's exactly what the president promised on the campaign trail. Sessions is doing it, and that's the political reason why the president can't really fire him, because the base and several congressmen have said, like, we will revolt, we will not confirm a successor, and we may, our support for you may waver. Now, there are also legal reasons the president shouldn't fire his attorney general, and that has to do with the Mueller probe, because Robert Mueller is looking at possible obstruction of justice by the president or anyone else. And if he fires his attorney general after so publicly criticizing his recusal, that's really not going to help that either. So there are legal and political considerations for the president, and he has chosen to instead just express himself on Twitter.
So Sessions is tuning it out. Are we, the Twitter readers, going to learn to tune it out? Because the first time it was, oh my gosh, everybody freaked out. And the second, ooh, he's getting fired. Third, ooh, it's happening for real this time. And now it's the 10th, and it's like, okay, the president's mad again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yesterday, my colleague from Fox News in the White House briefing called Sessions the president's favorite pinata. And that really does seem pretty accurate. Sessions doesn't really care. The president can't fire him, so the president needs an outlet to express what he believes is very real frustration, because the president wanted an attorney general like what he saw with Eric Holder, and how Holder and President Obama worked side by side. The president has said that he believes that Holder protected President Obama, and Holder took on a lot of controversial issues, particularly with civil rights, that the president couldn't really deal with. He helped him. He was a quote-unquote wingman. He sort of protected him in certain political issues. And the president sees what Jeff Sessions did, recusing, as the opposite of that. And that's sort of the crux of his outrage. But you have to remember that Sessions made his decision to step aside in the Russia probe based on the recommendation of career officials. I mean, that's how things work in the Justice Department. And you know, part of this is also just the president getting used to dealing with the bureaucracy and the procedure here in Washington when he's used to running a private family business.
But privately, do they talk at all?
Not that I know of. There have been several instances, you know, it's been going on for over a year, when I've checked in or I've asked him, have you spoken with the president? Even when he came here for an Alabama football event a couple months ago, he's in the same yard with the president. You know, these guys were buddies on the campaign trail. They see the world similarly. They didn't speak. So it's not a warm relationship.
Yeah, it
but
sound
again,
like it.
it is Sessions day in and day out delivering on the campaign promises.
All right. CBS News correspondent Paula Reed. Paula, thanks.
When KNX In Depth continues, some of the stories you may have missed, but we did not. You're listening to KNX In Depth with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
It is mysterious. It's been dubbed Planet Nine, the number that Pluto used to have. But like Pluto, may not be a planet at all. Latest theory from the University of Colorado is that Planet Nine may actually be a group of asteroids. They're producing signs that researchers had thought indicated the presence of a giant unknown planet to the outskirts of our solar system. But now, they're not so sure.
Well, the last surviving munchkin from the classic 1939 film The Wizard of Oz has died. Jerry Marin was 98. He played the lollipop kid. Yeah, that one. The lollipop, right. The one who gave Judy.
We know the song.
We know the song, yeah. The one who gave Judy Garland's character Dorothy an oversized lollipop. He was one of more than 100 little people who were recruited to play munchkins in the movie. Jerry Marin died at a nursing home in San Diego.
Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Mike Simpson. Thanks for joining us here on KNXC In Depth. Going to have more tomorrow at 1 p.m. CBS News coming up next.